Now, you're very welcome to the show tonight. I hope I find you well on this Wednesday evening. Before we start, I just want to say a huge congratulations to the Kerry team and to all the management and selectors and everyone that goes with it. You've done the county proud on Sunday, and hopefully it's the start of many trips Sam will be making home to the kingdom. I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on Stand Out with me, Ian O'Connell, is Rochelle Timothy. Rochelle played football with Roscommon, until a required brain injury brought her into the world of paracycling, and she hasn't looked back since, and even qualified for the Tokyo 2020 Paralympic Games. Sit back and enjoy the show. I like to bring on my guests kind of back to the start of their childhood and growing up. What were you like growing up? Were you sporty before everything else happened and stuff?
Yeah, so I was sport mad, I suppose, growing up. I played everything like soccer, Gaelic, whatever there was. I had an older brother and a younger brother, so they were into it as well. So we just always out in the garden, like kicking football, all that sort of stuff. So then during the summer, we'd just be obsessed with playing everything. Like you might have soccer one evening, Gaelic another evening. Then when I was younger, I suppose, because there wasn't many girls' teams, I was playing with the lads as well. So I used to travel to like a girls' team that was further away from my own club, like, and then I'd play with the lads in my own club. So yeah, I was definitely sport mad from the very start, yeah.
Was cycling something that you were into back then?
Yeah, so I suppose I had a bike and I live way out in the countryside, like, so I'd be cycling to my friend's house, that sort of stuff. I actually went to the community games, I think it was under 12, for cycling on grass. So I would have entered like a running and stuff like that, but then I actually just did the cycling and found that I was good at it. So yeah, I went to the community games twice for the cycling, representing Roscommon or whatever. So yeah, I suppose I was always into cycling, but I love team sports. So when I got to under 14 level or that, and when I was getting on the county team and I was playing soccer, National League, that sort of stuff, I kind of more veered towards the team sport things, and I just enjoyed, yeah, being around a team. So then the cycling kind of took the back foot, but I'd still do it like at the winter or to keep fit, that sort of thing, but I wouldn't have been racing or anything. Yeah.
You played with Ireland's Katie McCabe. Was it under 15, 17s?
Yeah, under 15, 17s. Yeah, so I was on the school's team under 15. She would have been on that as well. We'd be the same age. Like, so yeah, I suppose I was mad into soccer when I was at that standard, when I was on them teams. But yeah, like to play with some of them girls, like a lot of them, like Chloe as well, you know, Claire Shine and that, they're all in the kind of international setup now, Amber Bennett as well. So it's really good to see so many different girls on that team are actually gone into so many different sports. So Amy O'Connor was on it as well, and I know she was playing with the Cork Camogie team at the weekend, so it's kind of crazy to see. I think with the soccer, if you're good at Gaelic or Camogie or one of them sports, you kind of would have played the soccer growing up as well. So yeah,
a lot of people kind of if they play one, they always kind of play the other, especially when they're younger.
Definitely, yeah, yeah.
Like you said there, you were playing with the boys for a while. Do you think back then, because I remember Katie Taylor, she was boxing with, she kind of had to pretend she was a boy for a while when she first started out. Do you think that was more of a thing back then, that girls' sports wasn't as common?
Yeah, I think it was just that for me, like, we wouldn't have had enough to play in a girls' team, and the lads actually let us play. And I think as well, if you were anyways good, they wanted you to play. Like, so from the club I'm from, we would be a lower division or whatever, but the lads would have loved to have me and two other girls playing, because we would actually, do you know, we were good, like, and they didn't care that we were girls. I think when you're at under 12, under 14 level, they don't care, like. And then they actually brought in a rule, I think, when I was going on to under 16, that the girls weren't allowed to play, like, because obviously lads were so much more physical at that age, that they were saying it was a bit dangerous for the girls to be playing. But I remember going to Fela, I was the only girl on the team, like, I played in goal for the lads, and I think I was still under 12, like, but they wanted me on the under 14 team, sort of thing. So yeah, definitely, it makes you stronger, like, it makes you, lads kind of look up to you a bit better as well. Like, if you're able to play with the lads teams, you're obviously, you know, you're good and you're strong. And I didn't care, like, I'd play with anyone from having my older brother would be 2 years older. So I'd always kind of be in teams he was playing in as well. So that kind of helped. But at the time, there was no girls team, so you just went with it or you didn't play.
It was, like you said, it probably stood to you, you know, as you got older, playing with the boys at the start and when you were coming up through the ranks. You were no interest in hurling or anything that side of stuff?
No, not really. Like, the nearest, Oran would be the nearest kind of hurling camogie, and I think they didn't really have many camogie teams. My brother would have played hurling now, but he got into it when I was older, like, so I think I was gone past. I feel like it's something you need to do from when you're a kid, like camogie or hurling wise, just to get the skills. Like, I'd be going in, sure, I'd be missing the ball and everything, like, because I wouldn't have learned it until I was like 14 or whatever. So yeah, I know, but I can notice now with the local club, a lot are playing football with the football club, and then they're actually going up there to play the camogie, like, so it's good to see. And then I suppose they can decide what they're better at, what they prefer, what their friends are doing, all that. So it works, yeah.
It's good to have the, you know, to have women's teams now and the camogie and
Exactly,
stuff.
yeah.
Moving on then, as you when you got older, your life took a completely different turn, and you got into paracycling and stuff. Do you want to bring me back to what happened? And it's kind of a recurrent brain injury. And could you explain to the listeners what exactly happened?
Yeah, so in 2016, I acquired a brain injury after having this CyberKnife treatment, it was called, for, we'll say, a blood vessel that I had in my brain. It wasn't causing me any trouble, but it was a hereditary condition. So my father would have had it and that, and I had lungs previously treated. So it was kind of a radio surgery, non-invasive. It was a one-day thing. So I just went in and got it, and I was fine after. And then I suppose everything started to go downhill about 3 months, 6 months later. I started to kind of develop seizures. And they thought it was just epilepsy because I was kind of at that age where, you know, people who just get it for random reasons like growth spurts or, you know, adolescence kind of stuff. So then that kept happening. That was fine, got that treated. And then I suppose I just kind of noticed I was weaker. So I kept hitting my right foot off the step, things like that. And I suppose for a week, really, I was getting this on and off headache. I didn't really know what it was. I was playing county at the time. And I suppose the main point for me was, I went down to county training and I was trying to run around the cone. I could run perfectly to my left, but I noticed I was slower to my right. And I remember just dropping out and saying, oh, I have a bit of a headache or whatever. So I went to a few different doctors, college. I was at college at the time. So I went to the college doctor. I went to, like, out of hours, I went to my local doctor, loads of different. But I suppose by the time I had got to them in the middle of the day, the headache had kind of gone. So it was definitely, it looked like a migraine. So they were treating me for migraine or whatever and sending me home. And then I suppose a week after that, I just woke up one night and I couldn't move my right side at all, and my speech was a bit slurred. And I suppose looking on, it kind of would look like I was having a stroke or whatever. So I went straight to hospital. And when I got in, the nurse, long call nurse, was actually had worked previously in Beaumont. So she was used to neuro, and she was like, this is definitely neuro like. So I kind of came back round, but I was definitely weaker on my right side. Like, even they get you to hold your two hands directly out in front of you, like, and one was just dropping without me even realizing that was happening, like that sort of stuff. So got me straight in. I remember them doing the scan and I was thinking, oh, like, you know, they'll do the scan and they'll tell me what's wrong and I'll fix it and
Did
I'll be
a
home.
CT scan or something?
Yeah, it was an MRI. So they did that. And I remember, like, I had MRIs in the past, like obviously before the treatment, that sort of stuff. So you walk out and you can see all the screens. So when I walked out, like, that all the screens turned off and I was like, that's weird. And your mom was like, yeah, you're just going to stay here now and someone's going to come and get you. So that was when they kind of put me lying down and they basically put me in the neck brace. They didn't want me moving my head. So what I had showed on the scan was just massive swelling over the left side. So it was the front and the back and the side and the whole lot. And they were saying, like, that was obviously just building and building and building. But because I didn't really notice that headaches or whatever, but they said it was at a stage now that I could lose complete power if it got any further. So it was just a case of trying to stop that, trying to stop the swelling. So stayed in hospital for a couple of weeks, trying to get swelling down, all that sort of stuff. But in my head, I was so naive at the time that I thought it was like a broken ankle. Like, you get the swelling down and you're back to normal. I didn't think that, whatever, 5 years later, that even though the swelling is gone, this still obviously affects me day to day. So yeah, basically what they said to me was, give it a few months, give it a few months, that sort of thing. So different types of treatment. I had chemo, things like that, just try to get rid of the swelling. And eventually the swelling was down. I remember thinking, like, the swelling is down. Why am't I able to run? Why am't I able to do stuff? So that was when it kind of hit me that this is permanent. Like, so swelling was gone, but the damage was kind of done, you could say. So with the brain cells, like, they don't regenerate themselves similarly to what you might if you burn your arm or something, to regrow the skin, that sort of thing. So the brain doesn't do that. So for me, initially, I had to, like, learn different pathways. So let's say for me to move my right arm, my brain has to send the signal around where the swelling was. So it's just delayed, like, that sort of stuff. So yeah, I kind of, that was what happened, I suppose. And then the cycling kind of came on from that, yeah.
Was it I remember reading that nosebleeds and kind of spots and stuff can be a symptom. Did you, is it very common, the condition?
Yeah, so HHT is the condition. No, it's not, like, it's not, I suppose, really life-threatening or anthem, and a lot of people are walking around and have it. So the main symptoms would be, yeah, some people get nosebleeds that have red dots, but I literally had no symptoms, what my dad would. So that's kind of why I was tested in the first place. It basically is extra, like, arteries and blood vessels. So we'll say your lung capacity might be down because you have extra ones. But what they do is basically just coil it off and they literally evaporate away. Like, so it is really easy treatment. It is really easy to manage, but a lot of people don't know they have it. So for me, yeah, I'd no symptoms. Like, if I went in, they wouldn't have even tested me if it wasn't for people in my family having it or whatever. But really, the main cause and why I am here, I suppose, is because it is so rare that the treatment wasn't really fully researched, I suppose, and I got the brain operated on, whereas now, and from talking to other specialist doctors, it's something they wouldn't do. They just monitor, like. So really? I suppose I was kind of just the first person thrown in, and it didn't quite work out. So people actually don't get it now. So I could say, yeah, at the time I was obviously very annoyed at what happened and that I was used as a guinea pig and then I couldn't play sport or whatever. But I suppose looking from where I am now, and, you know, as a professional, basically getting paid to cycle my bike because of what happened, I have to take the positives out of it as well. So,
and like you said, it was just at a time where, when you were in the height of sports and stuff, and you were going so well. Did it take you a long time to, I suppose, accept it, or like, did it have a toll on your mental health or anything like that?
Oh yeah, like at the start when I go and tell my story as to what happened and how I got back and how I got into the cycling, that sort of stuff, I never really spoke about the mental health side of it. But the more I look back, the more it probably had a massive effect. So I suppose with what happened, I was always known as a footballer. Like, the previous year I had won an All-Star for Gaelic, and then I had been on college's soccer team of the year, that sort of thing. So really everything was in the direction of sport. You know, I was doing sports psych in college. I was on a sports scholarship, and in the space of about 12 months, that was all taken away. So I think for the first 6 months after, I was still as part of the teams, that sort of thing. I'd go to the matches. I was still in that. And then I think the most difficult thing was when the following season started. So from everyone looking on, obviously I was sick at the time and they knew I wasn't going to play, and everything's reset following season. So like WhatsApp groups, all that thing, when they're meeting, everyone's writing in like Snapchat groups, but which I wasn't in because I wasn't on the team anymore because I wasn't part of the team. So I think that was the most thing that impacted me. Like, my friends would have all been on teams, would have played sport, because that was my circle. Like, that was everyone I was always with. So then I felt like I was kind of excluded, not purposely, obviously, that's just the way it goes. Like, you're on the team 1 year, you're not the next. So then I kind of fell out with that. I kind of found that, yeah, all I was doing was either in bed, up, eating, back to bed sort of thing. Like, I had nothing to go and do. I remember the doctor saying to me, actually, like, what are your hobbies like? And I was like, sport. Literally, I had no fallback plan. I never had. Yeah. I always, from a kid, was going to do something in sport. Like, I was going to work in sport. My life was probably going to revolve around sport. And then suddenly I couldn't do it. So
is that what brought you into the sports psychology?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was how I had to find another way. And there's always coaches out there who I suppose can't do. So I used to say as a kid, like, they're coaching because they're not able to play, like, sort of thing, or they're not good enough to play. But now it's actually, I'm from the side of trying to coach and stuff because I have the experience and I can give back sort of a way. So yeah, it was all, my mental health definitely was, like, I stopped going places, I stopped doing things, I couldn't drive. So the weakness is still there now, but obviously I have adaptations and I can drive modified car and stuff like that. But at the time I couldn't. And I was always the person who drive my friends everywhere because I wouldn't be drinking because I'd have a match the next day, I'd have training the next morning, that sort of stuff. Like, so suddenly if I was going out, I had no excuse as to why I wasn't drinking. I was 21. I was the age where you were going here, there and everywhere every weekend. Like, so I think definitely, yeah, the more I look back, the more I probably isolated myself for the year or so. And then eventually just, yeah, finished my college degree. And I think that kind of gave me the push to get back out and doing stuff and just accept that this is the way it is now. And I need to make something of it, I suppose.
And it's so apparent to see, like, how far you've come, even mentally, even, you know, just talking to you here now. It was, at the time, it was only 30% you had in, was your left leg. That is,
yes.
That's got stronger now. What was your, I suppose, like, your rehabilitation like?
So I suppose, yeah, I was having, like, physio every week, every couple of days, hospital-wise. So initially, it was thought that I would go to Dún Laoghaire. But I suppose I was on that balance of being too good or not being bad enough, you know? So I was kind of left to just be at home, but get all the physio I needed and that sort of thing. And I remember I was going to the same physio. They were just trying to get me walking, you know, unsupported, walking in straight line, lifting my leg enough. I was someone, I didn't want to use a stick. I didn't want to not walk, sort of a thing. So I think for about 3 months, my muscle memory was probably carrying me. I could lift my legs properly. Yeah. I could do all that. So
wheelchair and yeah, everything.
Exactly. Yeah. So I thought, you know, I'm actually strong enough. They're making it worse than it is. But then as the months went on, lost the muscle, I'd say I lost more power. So then I did, I kind of had to, you know, I wore a foot splint. I still do kind of for drop foot, that sort of thing. Just, it's nearly safety now that I look at it more than anything, like just stopping me stupidly. Like people see me as an athlete, but I could still easily, if I wasn't paying attention, like just trip over nothing. So it is something I've kind of accepted, I suppose. But the physio was basically, there was actually a physio gone on maternity leave that I was going to. So I had a new physio and I walked in. They obviously were getting to know me or whatever. And they were like, and can you tell me when you had the stroke? And I was like, what? Like, I didn't have a stroke, but that's just how the brain, like similarly, it shows like a part of my brain is damaged and this is what it looks like. So we need to try and teach you a different way of doing things. And yeah, it took time, but I was probably stubborn in that, like, if you tell me I can't do something, I'm gonna do it, like. But obviously there's still things day to day I wouldn't be able to, like, just adaptations of the houses, like take out. People think for me it's better for me to walk down a slope, but it's actually probably better for me to go stairs, because if your foot is dropping, you're trying to catch up, like, sort of a thing. So yeah, it's definitely things I wouldn't even say to people about, because I think I just have them in daily going now, like that sort of thing. Like chopping, like cutting up food, that sort of thing is all just adapted, and you get used to it and you get on with it, I suppose.
And since when that happened to you at the time, say fast forward to now, have you seen progression and like improvements and stuff that adapt and help you with everyday life?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I suppose with the cycling, I probably strengthened my body overall, like got a stronger core, that sort of stuff, which has allowed me to do daily things I wouldn't have been able to do. I think for me, if you can call it lucky, I was left-handed. So it's my right side that's affected. Oh. So like, I actually wasn't using my right hand as much, and I had things changed to my left hand anyway from the way I was pure left-handed. Like, so yeah, I've changed things, but being sporty and being active, I feel no matter like how, we'll say, strong or whatever you could say your disability is, there's always being healthy and making your body as strong as it can be will increase your daily living as opposed to just your sport. So for me, when I was cycling and that, I'd always say to the physio or the S&C coach, like, this will improve my cycling, but like, I also want to do things that will improve my day to day. So when I stop cycling or whatever, I'm not just, I'm not going to lose all everything I've gained, like, sort of thing. So they're very good in that in Sport Ireland, like, and through the Para Games and stuff like that. They're very good to the athletes in that I'm making you a good sports person, but I'm also making it that you can do daily life as well as every able bodied person, like, so.
And I think that balance is, it's really important. We'll jump on to the paracycling now and how you got into it. It was you. Were you sent to like an open day when there were, where there was different type of sports being shown?
Yeah. So basically, I went into my GP just like a regular checkup, and she kind of said to me, you know, look into parasport. And in my head, like being a sports person, being in college, I knew what it was, but I thought it was for people. Wheelchairs, amputees, like visually impaired, they were kind of the three bases I thought it revolved around. I didn't realize I qualify, I suppose. And she said, no, brain injury, like disability, you can definitely qualify. You just probably need to be put in a class that makes it fair for everyone. So like there's different classes. So depending on the severity of your impairment, you'll go up or down the classes.
C3 or something.
Yeah, I'm a C3. So C1 to C5 for the cycling, it's different for every sport. So the ones would be the most severe and the fives would be the least. So the way I look at it is ones would be very, very noticeable. And then fives may only be their hand or fingers even. So I'm a three, so I'm kind of the in-between. So the way it goes is like my arm and leg are affected. So that on one side of my body, so that initially puts me into the middle category. So I was kind of fairly clear cut. So some people would be in between categories. And I think that's where a bit of the problems come about, where people are put in the wrong category. But for me, it was straightforward neuro. I was straight into the category. So yeah, I went to a cycling. I kind of looked through the sports myself. I obviously couldn't run, that sort of thing. Swimming was a bit out of the question just because of the brain, and I probably wasn't still stable enough.
Did you have sisters or something in the pool?
Yeah, it was just with the seizures, even though I hadn't had them, and as well, so I'd have some sensory issues. So like
Yeah.
when I touch the water first, there'd be a bit of shaking and stuff. Whereas on the bike, if I was warmed up, I'd just get moving and there was nothing. But it was just luck of the draw. So yeah, I went down to Cork for the first bike. They have like a TT, a time trial every month. So I said I'd turn up and I went, and Cathal Miller, who went to the Paralympics in 2012, was there, and he was just like, "You look sporty, we like you." Like, and I was like, told him the story or whatever, and he was like, "That's brilliant that there's not many girls in the sport, that you know there's good competition, it'll be competitive." And he basically said to me like, "Are you just doing it for fun?" And I said no, it was the first day I was there, and I was like, "I don't just want to cycle my bike, like I want to race." So I think that was the soccer and Gaelic coming out in me, like I always loved games as opposed to training, that sort
Were
of
you
thing.
always competitive?
Yeah, oh definitely, like over everything, like it could be to, oh, like literally to be in the front of a line for something, it's just mad competitive, like. So it definitely was something. And I did the first race and I was absolutely awful, but I finished and I was like, right, that's the first one, like I'm going to be better next time, better next time. I always wanted to aim for something. So yeah, it basically started from there, and that was 2018. Yeah, it was the end of 20, well, middle of 2018, and basically it all just escalated from there. And I went to an international competition at the end of that year, and I remember like I had beaten my time by so much that I was definitely on an upward progression, and I was looking at girls in my category. They
Was
were
that the
still
moment you
way ahead of me.
realized it was for you?
Yeah, kind of. But I remember at that competition, Chris Burns, he's another lad on the team with us now, and he said to me, you know, I did pretty well. And he was like, you know, this is the best thing that ever happened to you, like. And I was in my head, I was like, all right, okay. But I was still thinking, no, the best thing that ever happened to me is if I got back playing football, I got back on the pitch and played in Croke Park or whatever. But then looking back now, like he was dead right, like it is and it was, and that was the start of it really. So yeah, I just kind of progressed really, really fast from then. I suppose you all know about Katie and Eve, and you qualify points for your country for your, like, let's say male or female. So they had a lot of female points qualified already at that stage. So really, it was to get me to a level that I could compete and get some points. And that's basically what happened in 2019. I was called onto the elite squad, and I basically got a phone call from the coach, and he just said, like, would you come to Mallorca next week? And at that time, I had like a crappy bike. I had nothing. And he was like, I was like, yeah. He was like, right, okay, so here's what you need. And basically gave me a list of equipment, a list of what I needed. And he said, you're going to have to self-fund, like, for to get you going, because obviously you need to prove yourself before Anthony. And I always look at anything. Sometimes you need to put the money in to get the money out, I suppose. And for me,
Exactly,
money,
yeah.
I didn't care. Like, so I remember saying to my parents, like, I'm going to Mallorca next week or whatever. And they were like, right, how do we do it? And I had a car. I'd got at that time, basically put the car up in Dundee, sold the car, got all the equipment I needed. And then the following 2 weeks, I was gone. I was in Mallorca for 5 weeks. And prior to that, like I hadn't done more, I'd say, than 70 kilometers, but it was track. So it was short, sharp stuff. So it was just, they were just trying to get me fit, like, and I was just not going to give in, like. So yeah, it went from there. I got picked for the World Championships then on the track. I went to Apeldoorn, and I literally came second last and last in some of the races, most of the races, I suppose. But it was a start. It was gaining some points. It was getting me in the Ireland shirt. It was pushing on from that, and it did give me a good push. And then a year after that, in the 2020, which was the last competition before COVID, I won a bronze medal. So in the space of a year, I had been lapped and I suppose came last in a race, and then I was beating them girls by seconds the following year. So it just showed that this was for me, and that really gave me the boost and the push I needed. But yeah, I gave everything up, I suppose, for them 2 years, just to give all into cycling. And obviously it paid off with getting to Tokyo in the end, and you know, winning a medal internationally and stuff. So it definitely
Great the
takes
way you can
commitment
look
at
back now and like see where you are at the very start and then
the time. Yeah.
just a few months later and stuff. I know myself in my situation, like when I was coming home from hospital, if it was only turning on a light switch, it might take 10 minutes. But I was hugely like like they say, yourself's biggest critic. At the start, were you like that when you were, say, coming second last and stuff, or were you hard on yourself?
Oh, definitely. Like I'd always, which is a bad way to be, but I suppose I'd focus on what I couldn't do instead of what I could do. And I'd say, oh, I can't beat her, or I can't catch up, or I can't whatever. I think it took a while for me to kind of reverse that in that, yeah, I could or I can, or it'll take time, instead of trying to, you know, I was only there cycling for a year and in my head I was like, I'm going to win. But like, that's unrealistic. But at the same time, if I didn't aim high, I wouldn't have completed it. I wouldn't have been competitive. I wouldn't have pushed myself. Like, so it's a bit of both, but definitely, yeah, even after every race, no matter how good I go, I'll say, oh, I could have done better, I should have done better, could do this, could do that. But I think at the elite level as well, you need to be able to finish a race and say you gave it all. Like, so I think I am definitely still in that progression of learning how to do that, learning how to leave it all out there, and learning how to, I suppose, compete as a solo athlete. I still have that team mentality, and I perform really well, like, at races, and I perform well on camps because I'm surrounded by that team pushing you. So it definitely is the side of it that I would say I need to work on most, is just getting the best out of myself while I'm on my own, when there's no one looking at you, sort of a thing. So,
has being in an individual sport, has it helped you in other aspects of life, and like, say, other parts of life, and like your rehab that you're doing by yourself?
Yeah, definitely has. It has. Like, I think prior, obviously, when you're in team sport, you can rely on a lot of other people. So I think for me, and being in the solo sport, I needed to start being more resilient in, you know, you got to do this by yourself. And I try to get in my head that I'm doing a training session for myself to be successful. Like, instead of, you know, putting off the training session till later in the day or whatever, or waiting until someone is around. And I probably took a bit of time with the brain injury. I'd always be afraid, like, can I overdo it? Will I overdo it? Like, could this in worse than what I had? That sort of stuff. But obviously that was more in my head than anything. And eventually you get used to, you know, going on 4-hour spins, 5-hour spins by yourself. And I think it is good, because you have to go by yourself. You're not going to get back, like, sort of a thing. So definitely it has. And it's made me more resilient and more to stop relying on people. I suppose with a disability, people tend to, they offer help a lot, which is good, and which I'd never, like, some people don't want to be helped with stuff they're doing. But for me, I'm like, I do like that bit of, you know, we'll help you with this, help you with that. But then again, I wanted to flick the switch from being completely reliant on other people to being able to do stuff by myself. So it definitely helped with that. Yeah.
How important, like, in today's world, how important is, especially cycling and stuff, and when you're at such a high level, how important is, say, nutrition and rest and recovery and all that?
Yeah, so it's definitely a major part of the whole thing. So I think nowadays a lot more sports people are getting into the side of, it's not just about your training, it's about everything you do after and before. So like, what you eat nutrition wise, that you're fueling yourself for the next session, but you're also fueling yourself for what you do, like what you just done, what you just lost, that sort of thing. And then recovery wise, like for me, I'm probably another extreme in that you'd see in power sport. Like, obviously I have a neuro injury, so I would need extra sleep. I'd need extra recovery. I just need to, basically with neuro, like, you can reflick the switch by, as I say, by sleeping, oversleeping. So some days I might just need to sleep in the day for a couple of hours to get myself up and going again. Like,
really?
So I think it's taken me a long amount of time to realize, right, you need to rest today so that you can train tomorrow, because if you go today, you won't be able to train for 5 days, like that sort of thing. So it is a bit about that. And I think for myself, and I probably haven't really said this before, but post Tokyo, I probably said yes to too many things, and I kind of, the cycling was still there, but like, it wasn't getting the commitment it needed, and it took me a while to get myself back to not overdoing it. So, but that is the way people, I've spoke to other athletes, and they said it's normally like that. It's a bit hectic after the games, but because it's only a 3-year cycle now, you don't have that time to kind of let yourself go, or that time to do other things. And I know that now, looking back, that I probably have more work to do now than if I hadn't done as much post games or whatever. But I think there's a good few people in the same situation, and there's a few things I need to decide as well as an athlete, like whether I'm going to still compete on the road and the track, or are you just going to focus on one, that sort of thing. So I suppose now this year, a few of the decisions have been kind of made for us. We're due to go to World Championships in August on the road. It's a hilly course, which doesn't suit me, like, so I won't be going. And I've decided, like, to put all my time into the track, which is in October, and just, you know, try and base myself on that. Because I think with cycling, if you try to do too much, you're not going to excel in any one thing. You're going to just be average at everything. So it's a bit of decision, what you're going to do, what's best for the team as well, because you're qualifying points, obviously, and what's best for yourself to get the best out of yourself. So, yeah, I think being the 3 years, everything is fairly, like, hectic, it's compact, it's like you need to get up and going, that sort of thing. But I kind of like it the way I like that as well, because you can have a monthly aim, that sort of thing. So
it's all about the balance. Moving on to Tokyo, that was obviously a huge landmark, you know, from where you started. Now you're up in the pinnacle of sport and stuff. What was that like? You took part in, was it two track and two road races there?
Yeah, so I done the four, there's four events, I done all four. It was, for me, Tokyo was get as much experience as you can, learn as much from everyone else, but get the best out of yourself, you know, break your PBs, go as fast as you've ever gone and leave everything out there. So I think on the track, I did that, you know, I had personal bests. The time I would have done, the amount the sport has progressed is crazy. Like if I had done, the time I'd done in Tokyo would have got me a silver in Rio. So like,
really,
it just shows that, like, I came eighth. So it just shows the massive, like, everything has pushed on, everything, like aerodynamics, technology, I suppose it all just has made everyone go faster. So the goal for me is, you know, I need to be going as fast as the fastest ones. But yeah, the two track events went really well, two top 10s. So that was kind of what I was focusing on. But I think because of COVID, we didn't necessarily get the amount of practice on the track we would have hoped for. So I was 16 months where we didn't have access to a track because there's no track in Ireland. We obviously couldn't travel abroad. So that probably impacted us a little bit, which meant I put a good bit of work into the road as well. So it'll be interesting to see how we'll do going forward. You know, are we going to do the same thing? Are we going to put time into both? That sort of thing. So it definitely, I learned so much. I looked at the athletes who had been there before, who had been in Rio, who had been in London. And you have to do that as a young athlete, as we'd say in parasport, as a new athlete. You need to learn from the others because they have all the tricks. They've done it before, you know. So yeah, it was an amazing experience. It was great to be surrounded by a team of such successful athletes. Like we obviously came, the girls came home with 3 medals, and then Gary got a bronze, and Ronan, like I think Ronan just like 4th place, and he is, I would say, the strongest person on the team, like, but he is just in such a difficult category. And like, he's going as fast as able-bodied lads in Ireland on a bike. Like he did the Ross, and he's something else. Like he's what you want to be if you're an athlete. And I think for him to continue on to Paris is just, it's just so good to get to copy him, see what he's doing, ask him what he's eating, ask him what he's doing. You learn so much from them as well. So it's just to be in a great team. It's brilliant.
I'm always fascinated by the indoor, the track, because it's like a kind of like goes up and up high, doesn't it? There's no brakes. Is there brakes on the bike either?
No. So it's basically a fixed gear bike. So you pick your gear, no brakes. You can't freewheel. So if you freewheel, you go over the handlebars. Like, so in order to slow yourself down, you're just like gradually slowing your pedal stroke. And then to go faster, it's just whoever pedals the fastest. Like, so I think that's kind of why it probably suits me as someone with a brain injury, that sort of thing. Like, there's not much thinking. You just pedal as hard and as fast as you can. Whereas on the road, sometimes you're braking, you're going into corners, you're changing gear, you're doing it. There's a lot more to go on. Whereas on the track, I'm just like, right, I'm going to pedal as fast and as hard as I can. And what time that gets me, it gets me, like, sort of a thing. So that's why I like it as well. You can get some serious speed and you can use the track, like, so it's a 45 degree angle. So you swing right up to the top and you'll get the speed coming down. Like, and I like that. I like, yeah. So it looks really high. Like, it's actually the same angle at the top as it is to the bottom. But if you look down from the top, you're like, oh, how do you even go to that? Like, so on training, you need to be putting pressure on the pedals and you need to be moving at a certain speed or you'll just slip off. You'll just slip down. Like, so it is, it's scary, but I think I like that. Like, I like the bit of fear factor, I suppose. And, you know, how fast can I go? How much can I push this? Like, how close can I go to someone without touching them? That sort of thing. Like, it makes you go harder and faster. And I think I really like it. Like, the only thing I can say is I would love if there was a track in Ireland. Obviously, it's not something that's going to happen now, but I think we have massive talent in the field of track cycling. And it just takes away a little bit when you have to. For me, it's fine. I obviously have no family, young kids or anything. I can travel to Spain here, there and everywhere. I can come back. I can go again in 2 weeks. But like, for the ones who have families or who have kids or who are starting, you know, building houses, you're that sort of age, like, you can't be gone all the time, but you need to be if you want to do well in the sport. So I think that is costing some people. But, you know, for now, there's nothing we can do about that. Only you can do the training on the road, but it's just not the same. So
exactly. And like you said, it's probably only amount of time, and a track probably will come to Ireland. There is good for facilities in I don't know, is it Dublin? You see all the Olympic and Paralympic athletes training.
Yeah, so it's the Sport Ireland Institute, and it's kind of basically trying to be the center of sport in Ireland, which is, you know, they have the swim and they have everything there. So the goal would be to get the velodrome put in there as well. But, you know, money wise, obviously, when that's going to happen. But I think it's really good the way they do it. Like for me, I'm obviously a 5 hour round trip if I want to go there, but I try to go once a week and just fit everything in the one day. So as a carded athlete, you get access to like physio, nutrition, sports psych,
Oh,
like
that's very good.
SSE, all that sort of stuff is given to you. So you just try to go. I try to go and fit in, like, you know, chats with all of them while I'm up there, that sort of stuff. So there definitely is a huge support network, and it's really, really good. So yeah, I always say, like, if you lived in Dublin, you could do that every day. But obviously, where I'm living, you can do it yourself as well, but it's good to have the access when you need it.
Like, do you know the way you're in Tokyo now, and the weather and the humidity is obviously really different. Do you do a lot of, say, camps and trips abroad in Spain, like warm weather?
Yeah, so especially prior to Tokyo, we had to do it because it was going to be like so humid, so warm. So like I had a sauna, so basically I was doing every bike session on the bike, get back in while you're still sweating, while your heart rate's still up, get into the sauna and just get used to that humidity and that heat. I think I was actually probably one of the athletes who reacted well enough to heat. Like I wouldn't be a massive sweater, so I wouldn't mind the heat, you know. So I think I probably mightn't have had as much a struggle as some people may have, but it definitely was acclimatization, because if we'd go to Mallorca, we'd do the track, but we'd also do the road. So you try to do the track like whatever time of the day, but then you cycle home like midday or cycle back to the apartment midday and try to just get used to the heat, like. But obviously at the same time, as an athlete, you're trying to be smart. So you're getting used to the heat, which means you probably need to be drinking more. Like obviously nowadays everyone knows about sun cream and all that sort of stuff, but you're sweating as well. So you just like reapplying it, just being smart, like, you know, minding your health as well, because like dehydration just happens so fast that it could affect you for days going forward. Like, so it was just all about that. But again, you're surrounded by the team there, and you're seeing Ronan. Okay, he has drank 4 bottles of 2 liter water. It's like I need to catch up, like big time or whatever. So it's good to have them around you. But yeah, warm weather is important. Now this year, with where Canada is obviously kind of similar to Ireland, so we didn't really have to do as much preparation for that as we may have if we were somewhere else. So it really does depend on the year, it depends on the time of year, that sort of stuff. But the institute, again, there's a sports like physiology kind of center, and they kind of work around all that and different things, and they're obviously seeing other sports going to different things, so they're learning from that as well. But yeah, it's not just get on your bike and cycle, I suppose. It's everything else around it. So
Is there one you'd pick one over the other, track or road, that you enjoy the most?
yeah, I think I would definitely pick track. Again, I think I didn't want to put all into track, you know, because you don't have the facilities and it's hard to fully, you know, go all in. But I think I will do road as well, because, you know, I'll get points for the team, and I'll be able to, you know, get possibly a top 10. So I'd be realistic in that I'd be aiming for a top 10 on the road, whereas I could go on the track and I could aim for a top 5 or a medal, like. You know, so road wise, I think with my impairment, I think a lot of people, I try to explain that, like, if it's a flat course, I would probably do well. I can, you know, I'll hang in, and then if it's a sprint, anything can happen. But like if it's a hilly course, just with my impairment, I end up pedaling with just one leg. So once I hit a hill, I'm just like struggling so much to stay on. So there's some girls in my category that are amputees, so they'll go up a hill the same way they go on the flat. They wouldn't have that massive difference of power, whereas I would. So I'd struggle with that big time. And I think with the way this year has gone, 3 of the 4 events have all been hilly. And so really I've been like, you know, pushing, pushing, pushing for that top 10. It really does depend on the gradient, and it depends on who you're against in your category. Some girls are really, really good in hills. They mightn't be as good on the flat, like. So the same as the Tour de France riders, like some of them can go up a hill and some of them can sprint, like. So you need to focus on what you're good at. But I suppose I was thrown in as a new athlete. Try everything and see how you get on. So my progression in some sides have been a lot faster than they have in other sides. Like, doesn't mean I wouldn't do it, or it doesn't mean I'd like to progress more on the road, but it just means that like my progression mightn't be as fast or whatever. So
And like you were saying, going uphill, one of your sides of the body gets, I suppose, tired faster, wouldn't it, than the other?
Yeah, exactly. So I basically like on the flat, I could kind of carry myself, but I find once I get to a hill, my right side, my weaker side will basically switch off. So I'm nearly reliant on pushing and pulling the pedal with my left side, whereas normally you can push with both. So I'd find as well, you do two races one day after another, or maybe a day in between. So if I had something hilly on the first day, like my good side would be like quite sore going into the next stage, you know. Whereas if I had a flat, I wouldn't be as fatigued. But
Yeah.
that's para sport, and that's what you see with athletes, and you just need to learn how am I going to make the most out of it? You know, should I not do this time trial and focus on the road race? You know, you need to be smart, but yeah, it's definitely something. It's interesting as well because a lot of athletes in my category might be better at turning one way than the other because of their impairment. So you get to know the girls and you get to know, should I be behind this one or not? That sort of thing.
Oh,
Like,
yeah.
so it's definitely a lot more thinking than what you think, I suppose I could say. So yeah, I'm still learning for sure.
It's all part of it, like you say. And before we finish up, what's Paris is probably obviously on your radar already, and probably has been even during Tokyo. What's coming up in the near future? Have you any competitions?
Yeah, so I suppose my main goal for this year will be the Track World Championships. They're in October in Paris. So I have a good block now leading into them. Some of the team is going to the Road World Championships, which is in August. So normally there would be more of a gap. So I think you kind of needed to decide or focus on, I suppose, one or the other. So for me, yeah, I'm going to push all into the track. And for this year, it's all about just getting the points. It's about getting a higher result as you can. Progression, obviously, go faster than you went in Tokyo. And then next year, again, it'll be another big push for points. But really, the long-term goal would obviously be Paris. But I want to make sure that this time, you know, I'm going into Paris as a medal contender. You know, I've got my experience. I'm learning now. I want to compete like I want to be at the top. I think for me as a competitive person, I don't just want to be say, oh, I'm top 10 in the world, that's brilliant, you know. You want to be better, and every time I race, I want to say, right, I left everything out there, do you know. So yeah, we'll go with track in October, and then we'll push on for next year. Yeah.
Very good, and all the best to you in that and what's coming in the near future and stuff. Thanks a million for coming on now, and I really appreciate you coming on. You've an amazing story, and thanks very much. Now, unfortunately, that's all we have time for tonight. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I appreciate you tuning in as always. I just want to say a huge thank you to Rochelle for her time, for coming on and having a chat with me this week. If you've any suggestions, questions, or requests for next week's show, you can contact me through my Instagram, enoconnell321, or through my email address, ioconnell@radiokerry.ie. I hope you're all having a great week. I'll be back at the same time next Wednesday night from 8 to 9 p.m. Until then, stay safe and mind yourself.